From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in November of 1994, a seemingly normal fall day for a teenager named Chris Thompson. At least it started off that way. He doesn't remember everything about that day, but he remembers a lot. He had cereal for breakfast. He packed his Tupac cassette tapes into his backpack before going to school. His morning English class was boring, but trigonometry was going to be exciting as it always was, until he got pulled out of class. And that was the moment that Chris Thompson found out he no longer had a home. Writing for 540 West Main, Chris describes what it was like to be a kid who was suddenly evicted, coming home to find his belongings soaking in the rain, wondering where he and his mom would go next. Today, Chris is an engineer, a comedian, an activist, a writer. At the time, he was a kid whose future was dissolving by the hour. Where would he live and how? Thompson writes, quote, "You can never tell by someone's looks what their economic status is. You have no inkling who is poor or houseless, and their supposedly nice shoes or clothes are not an indication of a grift if they ask for help. We shame and question them any time they try to eke out any joy from their lives. We shame people for using programs that are designed to help the poor, claiming that they are lazy and just not working hard enough when poor people usually work 2 to 3 jobs to get by. Then we shame them more if they can't raise their children the way we think they should. Then we gut the programs that they used to just barely get by, impoverishing them even more." End quote. The story of what happened to Chris that year is difficult to read, but it is gripping and it is important. And I've asked him to come on this program to share it and to discuss issues related to homelessness, particularly with the backdrop of this. We've seen just this week state legislators in Albany raising their own ideas for how to address homelessness, how to address a housing crisis, and we'll read some of their statements later this hour. But first, Chris Thompson, welcome back to Connections, and I'm so glad to see you in studio.
Yes, this is very nice and very strange at the same time.
Strange, but very happy strange for me.
Yes.
Great to see you. So I sort of imagine this was hard to write. I mean, but you're kind of an open book. You're very open about what your life experiences have been. But this is sort of another level. Why did you decide to write this now for 540 West Main?
So I wanted to write this back in December. A couple of things were going on in December. There was a big controversy. Someone was being evicted, and a couple of activists, tried to block the eviction. And that kind of triggered me a little bit, because people were asking why this woman couldn't notify the landlord. I guess there was a deal going on with them. Why would she rent from a racist landlord? Because apparently it came out that he had a couple of racist tendencies, and people just don't understand. If you're desperate to find a home, you're going to get a home by any means necessary, and you're probably not going to. You don't have time to look for a home. That happened, and I was frustrated with that. And then another thing happened where Monroe County Sheriff's officers were clearing out a tent encampment under a bridge. This story I got secondhand from a friend of mine who works at a coffee shop. These people, after clearing it out, they were actually sharing pictures and laughing about the fact that they cleared out a homeless encampment. And that kind of set me off, because that's just this utterly disgusting to do in the middle of December, in the dead of winter. And, I understand that they may make the excuse that, they want them to be safe and in a warm place, but there aren't enough shelters to house all the homeless people who are in Rochester.
So those are some of the things that sparked it for you.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up in Baltimore?
Yes. So yeah, from basically from high school, from age 13 all the way up to 24, 25, I lived in, Baltimore was my home.
And I just want to ask you, before we get into the actual story, which I think people will really find gripping and important, you use a phrase houseless, not homeless. I don't know if that was a choice, but I want to make sure I'm understanding the choice there.
So, yeah. So a better term is houseless, because what we're talking about is shelter. We say homeless all the time. We've been saying homeless for years. I still say homeless for myself.
Just sort of reflexively?
Yeah, just reflexively. It is like a thing where, you know, the language is changing. You know, language evolves. Language is changing. The reason that people say houseless and why it's probably better to say houseless and homeless is because home is wherever you make it. Like, whatever you have. Like, if I live in, I don't know, on campus, and this is where I make all my serious bonds with people, and this is where, you know, the family that I choose comes from, then that's my home. Whereas with houseless, you know, that means I just literally don't have shelter. Like, I don't have a place to say that I live. I don't have a residence. So that's kind of, this is my understanding of it, and this is how it was told to me, mm-hmm. like when I was, you know, when I was even talking about this, my own personal story, that's basically the way I understand the difference between homelessness and houselessness.
So that morning in November, it was a Wednesday in 1994, mm-hmm. you wrote for the piece that, you know, there's quite a lot you still remember. You remember waking up having cereal,
mm-hmm.
stuff in your cassette tape. I remember cassette tapes.
Oh, man, cassette tapes.
You had a lot of cassette tapes.
Oh, I had 100. I had 100 cassette tapes, and I was, like, building up this quite impressive, like, underground rap collection. And then I had the ones that I was really, like, I had Warrant for some reason and Def Leppard. And I was kind of mad that those are gone. Yeah, yeah. Now, a black
Nobody's
kid
perfect.
In Baltimore with a Warrant tape. Like, Cherry Pie? Like, why did I have that?
Was that popular among black kids in Baltimore?
Oh, absolutely not. No. I hid it under the bed. It was almost like it was porn. Like...
So that morning, geez, oh man, we're not supposed to be laughing because this is serious, but Chris is always making me laugh. He's a comedian. So that morning, you know, you stuffed a few cassette tapes into the outer part of your backpack.
Yep.
That's what you often did, right? Because it sounded like it was a long ride for you to school.
Yeah, yeah. It was about, it could go anywhere from like 45 minutes to like an hour and a half. Yeah, you know how buses work. Like, even, you know, buses in pretty much every city, you're going to miss a bus, you know, schedules are going to be off, a bus is going to be late. So I anticipated about like an hour and a half of bus ride. So I got all the Tupac tapes that I had, because for whatever reason, I was on a Tupac kick that week. And I put them, you know, in the front part of your JanSport. And then I just, you know, I headed to school.
You got to school, and it seemed like a pretty normal day. You said English was sort of boring,
mm-hmm.
but you loved trig, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah, that was my second period class. Trig, I was, like, averaging 100 in it, which, like, how?
I don't know anybody who's ever averaged 100 in trig.
Yeah, I really
didn't even take
that
trig.
Class.
I barely got through, like, basic algebra.
Oh, yeah. Algebra, interestingly, I was getting, like, low Bs in algebra, but for some reason, trig just made sense. Don't ask me why. It was my favorite class. I just loved doing trig.
And before you even really got in there and got settled, someone pulled you out in the hall. What happened?
Yeah, so my trig teacher pulled me out in the hall. Mr. Henderson, big, tall dude, like super tall black dude, a little bit balding and just like very bellowing voice. And like, I thought I was in trouble, because usually when he pulls somebody out in the hall, it's because you're in trouble. But like he said, yeah, you have to go to the office right now. And he didn't sound like there was anything wrong. Like, he didn't have that tone. He just had like a somber tone in his voice. So I'm not sure if he knew what was going on or if he was just relaying a message. But, you know, it was a very almost deadpan. And like, I was walking and trying to figure out what could have happened, that I have to go to the office.
I mean, you're 17 years old, right?
Yes.
Were you were a senior?
Yes.
Senior in high school?
Yep.
Okay. And what happened next?
I'm like turning the corner of the, you know, of the hallway and heading toward the office. And I see my mother walking up, and she like pulls me closer, and she's just like, yeah, we got evicted. And we need to go to, you know, the housing services. I forgot the name of the, you know, the Baltimore version of, mm-hmm. you know, the housing services.
Yeah.
But we got to go there. We got to, you know, fill out some forms. We're going to find a place to live in you know, through Section 8 and, you know, sign him for Section 8 and all this stuff. And, like, she's saying all this, but, like, all I heard was we got evicted. And then I didn't, it was kind of, like, I don't know exactly what she said, but, like, based on where we were going, I kind of knew. And I kept asking about her stuff, like, do we need to get, like, a U-Haul? Do we need to, you know, get our stuff out of the house? Who's taking care of that? And, like, none of my questions were being answered because she's focusing on getting to the office where we need to be.
Was it just you and her living there?
Just her and me.
And, yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's a lot to process. In fact, you said before this program began, there's a lot you remember about not only that day, but in the months that followed, but there's stuff that's sort of blacked out for you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like, I don't remember, like, I was staying with, I only told two people my age. I told one person in the school, and he actually helped me out a lot. He and his parents helped me out a lot, like when I had to, like, leave campus and, like, find a place to live. I spent a few months with him. And then there was a friend from church who was, like, actually in the school that was, like, kind of next door to my school, or up the street from my school. We stayed with them for a couple of months, like, right after.
Before we get there, though, I really want to I was deeply moved by the image of what happened that day when you finally got back to the house where you'd been living to look for your stuff. I mean, you're 17.
Yep.
You had not only the 100 cassette tapes, you had stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What happened when you finally got back home that day?
Most of my valuable stuff was gone. You know, I had, like, you know, I had a boombox. I had like a Sega Game Gear, which is, you know, the Sega version of a Game Boy.
Yep.
Those were gone. Like, all the electronics were gone. My Genesis.
They just took them?
People vultured it like that. Like, it probably happened even, like, it probably happened that morning, honestly. Because, to my understanding, the sheriff came by with people who were, you know, going to throw the stuff out. And they just, like, went to town and just kept emptying out the house. It was a townhouse. And then people just, like, picked over it and, you know, nobody did anything about it. The sheriff didn't do anything about it because, like, technically, I guess it was not anybody's in their minds. So, but by the time I got there, you know, it was dark. It was raining. My portfolio, I planned on going to art school, and my entire portfolio was exposed to the rain and just a mush mess.
Like waterlogged.
Oh yeah, waterlogged.
Ruined.
Yeah, none of my sketchbooks or anything survived. My drafting table, I don't know if they did it on purpose or not, but, like, when they took the drafting table out, it was a foldable drafting table, which is easy for travel, but for some reason it was just split right in half. So, like, I didn't draw for, like, about 4 or 5 years after that.
My God.
I didn't have it in me to do it.
Your books were waterlogged, unreadable, you wrote?
All my books were waterlogged.
Just destroyed.
Yeah. I had a modest comic collection back then, too. That was gone. That was mush, and that was back when the comics nowadays are on, like, some pretty decent paper, but, like, comics from the 80s and 90s, they were on, like, almost, like, it almost felt like newspaper.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they were all ruined. They were all gone.
Books, comic books, ruined. What about all those tapes?
All those tapes. Yeah. Surprisingly, even the warrant went. Like, so somebody in the neighborhood was into cherry pie, too. But.
Wait, so people just took them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Those were stolen. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, they, like, I put them in a... I'm an organized person in general, so I had, like, a cassette box, like, just, like, a cassette case, probably from, like, Case Logic or something like that. So they were all organized.
I remember Case Logic.
Yes, oh, yes. Yeah, R.I.P. Case Logic. They probably just, like, took the whole thing. It's all right there.
Yeah, so. I mean, I think this is one thing that kids growing up now, like, don't really understand is how personal tape collections were, because you know, you could make your own mixes.
Mm-hmm.
I used to record stuff off the radio. I used to record weird stuff. I used to record like songs I was looking for. Mm-hmm. There were certain DJs I liked.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, when I wanted to be the next Cleveland Cavaliers radio play-by-play announcer, I used to tape Cavs games off. I used to tape weird stuff off the radio, but I had all these tapes that were very much me.
Right.
And if anybody ever took them, I would go like, why? Like, that's part of me.
Yeah.
Did you feel like part of you was gone there?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Like, and even going into that, like, we would exchange mixtapes like love letters.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we would do that all the time. There was this mixtape going around the high school. It was all slow jams. So
was
like,
it very smooth?
It was very smooth. It was like Jodeci. It had... Public Announcement on it. It had like all these, you know, all these artists on there. There was a reggae mixtape going on, and I got a copy of that, and like that was gone.
Mm.
And like the ones that I just made for myself were gone.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, I like this is probably why I kind of like forgot some of the stuff, because like I definitely felt numb for a very long time.
Yeah, and Saito, now, I mean, you're an engineer now, and you have been for a while. Do you think you would have become a professional artist?
That was a goal. Like, that was a goal. I was, like, looking at the Maryland Institute College of Art. It's right in downtown Baltimore. I was building my portfolio. It was, like, you know, it was mostly, like, charcoals and stuff, but, like, I wanted to do more media. And, like the previous summers, I would do classes to learn how to like water paint, how to do pastels. I took a sculpting course one time, and like in the summertime I was going to take another bunch of courses just to get down you know, live figure drawing and all that stuff. And like that was a goal of mine, to become like a graphic artist and do graphic design. And you know, once my portfolio was destroyed, like starting over something that you started, you know, 4 years ago, it's daunting. And like, I was not in the headspace to do it at all.
Talking to Chris Thompson, who is a writer, an engineer, a comedian, an activist, and he is a contributing writer for 540 West Main online, and wrote a piece recently about that time that he found out he didn't have a house anymore. He was 17 years old. And Chris's piece is about his own story, but it's also about the assumptions we make about people we think we know, or people that we assume would never have gone through this, or what we assume that experience is like when it is almost invariably even harder than you think. And so what happened next is this series of events that just, again, it's really hard to even conceive of people going through. So you write that you and your mom stayed at a church friend's house until you wore out your welcome. Mm-hmm. Then you stayed in an extended stay hotel.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
So, yeah, we were, it was a little bit weird. Like, we were staying at my, you know, the church friend's house for a while. And, you know, we wore out our welcome. The mom said that I could stay, but, like, my mother would have to go. My mother and the cat would have to go. And, like, that just wasn't going to happen. It was going to be all or nothing. So, we went to this, I can't even remember. It was like a mom and pop, like extended stay hotel. We were there for a little bit, and we could barely afford it. Like extended stay hotels, like you'd be paying like a good like $1,000 or so a month. So that wasn't feasible. And I think my mother was under the impression that like the waiting list for Section 8 would reduce very quickly, which it didn't. And like while we were there, we got in contact with a person. My mother had like she would like sell spices, and she had like a little stand at one of the smaller malls. And this woman that she knew introduced her to somebody whose name I can't remember, but I think I called her like Gloria.
Gloria.
Yeah. Yeah. This woman named Gloria, who is on Section 8, and she's in a nice place on Section 8, and she said that she'd be able to game the system for us if if my mother shells over a little bit of cash just to like, you know, grease a couple of palms. And my mother believed it. So she did that.
She gave her money.
Yep, she gave her money. And then she was talking about how, like, she'd be able to get her, like, a stipend or something. She didn't call it a stipend, but, like, something like that for my mom so that we'd be able to, like, go out and get, like, an apartment and all this stuff. Or at least extend in the extended stay. And then when that didn't happen, she said, well, you can live with me, but you got to be, like, it's got to be, like, you know, under the table. Like, nobody can know you live here. And I for a while I didn't put this in there, but like for a while I thought it was my fault that we got caught, quote unquote. I didn't realize, like I knew that she was grifting us after a while, but like at this point, like, you know, I gave my friends like that phone number and I said, yeah, I just moved, you know, we just moved to a new place. And like, so my friends were calling me at that number and we got, you know, something happened where like there was one day that like Gloria was like speaking really loudly on the phone in the morning and it was very theatrical now that I think about it, and talking about nobody else is living here and blah, blah, blah. And then like she comes out of her room and she says that we have to go.
Just like that.
Yeah. But first we got to give her $200 or something. Like it was odd. And at this point, like I didn't have a job at the time, so it's not like I could shell over any money. So yeah, my mom, you know, shelled out $200. We went back to the extended stay.
So this relationship with Gloria that was supposed to help you turns into just another place where you lost money.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't have a place to permanently stay. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a lot of cash, too. It was like, it was definitely, like, I had a trust fund of, like, $5,000. And I know that my mom used some of that to pay the rent in the previous place. And I think Gloria got, like, a good $4,000 out of us. So, like, just kind of emptied us out. Like, we already didn't have anything.
Wow. And meanwhile, you know, you're still trying to go to class and finish senior year, right? You're thinking about going to college. Can you give us a sense for what all of this movement and this houselessness is like for a 17-year-old turning 18, trying to graduate high school, thinking about your future, and all of a sudden this happens?
So it's very, there's a lot going on. Like socially, you don't tell anybody you're homeless. Like it's a shame to be homeless. Like we, you know, it's high school. Everybody's been to high school. Everybody knows how much jerks high schoolers can be. So like any hint of poverty, people are going to make fun of you about it. That's just the way it is. I have no home. I literally have no money. So I hid that from everyone except my friend Walter. He was the only person who knew. And the only reason I told him was because I snapped at him the day before because I was completely like out of it. They were joking around. I didn't feel like joking around and I snapped at him. And then I, you know, I went back, you know, I called him up and I told him what happened, that we lost our home. And he understood. And, you know, that was it. Nobody else knew. Like people I talk to now from high school know now, and they just found out from this essay, and I didn't realize that.
And to say nothing of being a 17-year-old who might want to date, right? Like, might have a social
man.
Life.
Well, luckily, I was extremely socially awkward, so that wasn't too big a deal.
You're so smooth. You're like the, like, you know, this confident guy.
Oh, not in high school.
No?
Not in high school. Like, I did have, like, I did try to date. Like, I did have a girlfriend for, like, maybe a month. But, again, this was, like, during a time that I was in transition. So, the phone tag that we would do. Like, nowadays, you know, teenagers are, you know, texting each other
all the time. Yeah.
But, like, no, we would have conversations on the phone with people for a long period of time, annoying the hell out of her parents and all that stuff. So my number would change like every couple of weeks sometimes because we'd be in a different place. So yeah, dating was very odd. Somehow I still managed to get a prom date though. So That I guess that was nice. But
Chris, you said that summer your mother went to live in a women's shelter.
Yes.
But you couldn't go.
I couldn't go. It was a shelter that would not allow any males between, like, from like 14 up or something like that. It may have been even more restrictive, but like it was bad. That was the first time we were separated from each other throughout this whole thing.
And you get accepted to Morgan State University on a full ride with housing.
Yes.
How big was that for you?
It was huge. For one thing, Morgan, for people in Rochester, Morgan is kind of like the Harvard of HBCUs. And I guarantee you, anybody who goes to any other HBCU is going to say their school is the Harvard of HBCUs. But you know what? That's fine. I wanted to go to Morgan. Like once my dreams of going to the Art Institute were dead, like the thing that I could fall back on was like math and science. So I wanted to go to Morgan. I was too late to like fill out an application, but somehow I got in. My mother happened to know like the dean of students from like, God, like 30 years prior, like way, way before I was born. And she talked to him and he said he could see what he could do. And then all of a sudden I was told to apply even though it was too late, and I applied and I got in. And then like a couple of weeks later, thanks to my grades, I think that was a one blessing, is that like throughout this, like I was so like dejected from everything. The only thing I felt like doing was my homework. So yeah. my GPA like shot up like high. I wound up on, like, I'd never been on honor roll, and I wound up on the honor roll like the last half of the year. So like all that helped me get this scholarship. And then I had housing. Like I had an address.
Yep.
Finally.
But your mother didn't. And
no.
And you wrote that she moved from shelter to shelter. So you're in this position now where you go off to school, you've got housing, but you don't even know where she is some of the time. You don't have a phone number for her. You have to wait for her to call you.
Mm-hmm.
How hard was that?
It was kind of rough. Like the first couple of weeks, it was very weird because like I knew where she was. I even did a summer program. That's another thing I didn't put in there. I had a summer program, and actually it was during the summer program that we got like re-evicted from that extended stay place. And we lost our cat because of it. The guy just took the cat to a shelter, and there's no telling what shelter. So she tells me this like in the middle of the summer program. And so like now I don't know where I'm going to go when we leave the summer program. And then like when it was over, I think I stayed with my friend, the one friend that I told from high school. I honestly can't remember. I'm pretty sure it was him that I stayed with. So like, it was hard because like, I'm trying to focus on my grades and I'm trying to keep this scholarship. And like, I don't know where my mother is gonna be, like from week to week. Like usually they let you stay in those shelters for a couple of weeks, sometimes at the most, and then you gotta move to another place. And we had a caseworker, and the caseworker, I'm not sure how helpful she was, but like I know that a lot more of our stuff disappeared in like all these transitions. So
let me just put a little closing point on this long odyssey that you and your mother went through. And then what we'll do is, Richie, if you're on the phone, we'll take you and we'll take some feedback. And we're going to talk about some of the lessons here, particularly as lawmakers look to try to address some of these issues in our community now. You write, quote, "Finally, at the end of 1996, this is almost 2 years later here, right?
Yes.
Section 8 housing came through. I was still in school, but I at least had the peace of mind to know that I wouldn't have to try to crash another friend's holiday break, that I could go to a place I'd call home. It was a small place, but we didn't have much stuff anyway. We got cats again. I spent most of my time either at school or staying for weeks at a friend's house, usually the same friend who I told I was homeless in the first place. We were still very much poor, which led to a lot of problems, from arrests to suicide attempts. but at least for my last 2 years of college, I had a permanent address.
Yep.
How did your mom do during that time?
Throughout the 2 years, I know that there were at least three. She tried to attempt suicide at least three times, probably more, because, you know, there were months on end that I wouldn't see her. I know that I tried to attempt suicide a couple of times. I tried to do suicide by cop. Like, I would just, like, walk around at night with something shady in my hand. I had a broken bottle one time, just walking around at night, just hoping that someone would pick me off. Ironically, this is the one time that cops didn't bother me while I was walking around. So I guess that's good. I lost a lot. I don't know how many friends I lost because of this, because I definitely snapped at a lot of people at high school. I don't know if they'd forgive me. Like, maybe they would. I don't know. I don't know. The ejection of all the things that I thought made me, like a lot of the material things, you know, yes, they are replaceable, but like, just like we were talking about with the cassettes and stuff, like that's, you know, this is how teenagers like develop themselves.
Yeah.
Music is very, very powerful to people. And, you know, I had like no identity for a while because of that. Like, I didn't know what to do with myself. I'm still trying to rack my brain as to like some things that happened. Like, you know, there was I had to like try to bail my mom out of jail because she wrote a check that she knew was bad, but she just needed some money for food. But like, she thought that she'd be able to replace the money, and it didn't happen. So there was one time I had to skip class to go run around and figure out which jail she was at, and then figure out how to, you know, bail her out, if I could bail her out. Mm-hmm. It wound up I couldn't. Like, I did all just running around for nothing. And then they like let her out like a week later.
Talking to Chris Thompson, and when we take this only break, we'll come back and take some phone calls and feedback. We're going to talk to Chris about what he hopes people gain from understanding this story. And when we come back, we'll also have Chris tell you where you can find more of his work, podcast, and a lot more. Chris is a contributing writer for 540 West Main, which is where his piece on being houseless, or perhaps you would use the phrase homeless. He tends to use the term houseless, but those 2 years of his life in the mid-1990s, what that was like for him, for his mother, for that family that lost so much. And frankly, he knows this story affects so many other people in similar ways. So we'll come right back with Chris, and we'll get some of your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, NPR reports that there has been a sharp, off-the-charts rise in alcoholic liver disease among young women in particular. Cases are way up over the last year, and pandemic stressors have been a big factor. So what really is behind it? What do we do about this? If it's not you, it could be someone you know suffering with it. We'll talk all about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Ritty in Rochester on the phone first. Hi, Ritty. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. Hi, Chris. My name is Ritty, and I'm with the Citywide Tenant Union of Rochester. Evictions and houselessness are deeply traumatic, as we've heard today. And Chris, we really appreciate you sharing your story, even though it must be so difficult. So I just wanted to share some context on what's going on locally and some of the legislation that we're calling for that could prevent this cycle of evictions and houselessness we've been talking about today. So first, evictions are, in fact, still happening locally, even with the moratorium. So Judge Michael Lopez, who evicted Cleonda Florence Yarde in December, he saw 22 eviction cases just today. So that's one day in Rochester City Court. And no one's tracking the data on evictions locally, but anecdotally, we've seen that almost all the tenants facing eviction are Black and Latinx locally. Many of these are families with children, so evictions are a racial justice issue. So we're calling for a few pieces of legislation. The first is, good cause eviction protections. These would give tenants the right to renew their tenancy, enhance their right to organize, and provide protection against unreasonable rent hikes. basically good cause would shift the burden of proof to the landlord to show an eviction is warranted, so someone's not just getting kicked out because they called code enforcement. We're also calling for the permanent right to counsel beyond the pandemic, ensuring that tenants have legal representation in eviction cases. We've seen during the pandemic that when tenants have legal representation, they are more likely to stay in their homes. And just lastly, we had a pretty major victory recently. Our group and others like Vocal New York called on our elected officials to pass the Housing Our Neighbors with Dignity Act, also known as HONDA. This act would convert unused buildings like hotels, office buildings into housing, giving families like Chris's in these crises somewhere to go. So that act has actually passed the Senate and the Assembly, and we're waiting for Cuomo to sign it into law. This is going to be really big for folks in New York State, especially houseless folks who need somewhere to live, who need that stability, so they're just not caught up in the cycle of, you know, going from a hotel to a family friend. So we're really thrilled about that. We're, you know, waiting for Cuomo, but we're also really grateful to folks like Assemblymember Bronson for his advocacy on this issue.
Yeah, and if I could, Rudy, before I let you go, let me read the statement that Senator Cooney sent, in which he also references Assemblymember Bronson's support on a certain bill. The headline from Senator Cooney was, "First ever Rochester Housing Court passes the Senate," and just reading from his release there. "On the final day of the legislative session, the Senate passed Senator Jeremy Cooney's Housing Court bill. The bill establishes the first dedicated city court part exclusively focused on housing in the city of Rochester. This court will expedite housing hearings for tenants and landlords. Additionally, as a court that is focused on housing, judges and attorneys will be experts on housing law, which will help ensure fair outcomes. Senator Cooney's legislation was modeled after a similar housing court in the city of Buffalo. The bill also creates an advisory council for the court, which will include representatives from tenant organizations, the real estate sector, and civil legal providers who will review and report on the functions of the court. The New York State Senate passed the legislation, and now it heads to the Assembly for a vote tonight, and the bill is sponsored by Assemblyman Harry Bronson." Does that line up with what you're telling us, Ritty?
Yes, yes. We're really looking forward to getting this housing court in Rochester, and yeah, we're grateful to all of our local delegation who's been supporting these bills.
I appreciate that. Anything you want to leave with listeners before we let you go, Ritty, about what comes next or what you're hoping people do?
Sure. So, I mean, definitely if you want to call your local representatives to ask them to pass good cause eviction protections and the right to counsel, that will be a really great benefit to tenants, not just in Rochester, but all over New York State. We are, you know, the eviction moratorium goes up at the end of August. You know, evictions are happening. There's going to be even more then. So we really want to make sure tenants are as protected as possible.
Thank you, Ritty. Please keep us apprised of this.
Yes, I will. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah, thank you very much. Talking to Chris Thompson, and I'm curious now, understanding your story, at least from your teenage years into your college years and the evictions you went through, what's your relationship with landlords been like for the last 20 years or so?
They've been up and down, I'll say. They've been up and down. I'm lucky enough now that I live in a house. My landlord is actually my friend too. So we've had very good and open conversations. At the beginning of the pandemic, he said that, like, if I have any issues, to just let him know ahead of time and we'll work something out. And it's like, fortunately, with the job that I have now, I haven't had any rent issues, but like, it's really nice to know that, like, my landlord is that understanding. That said, he's also only owns one place. Like, he's not like these landlords. Like, the you know, there are certain not great actors in the Rochester community who own like 30, 40 pieces of land, and they're the ones who are like administering these evictions, especially to people who are the most vulnerable. My landlord before that was one of those landlords. And even though I was in a relatively decent house, he also had, like, I was minding my business and some Housing Equality Authority of New York called me because he was under investigation for racist activity. And then I found out after I left that one of my old neighbors told me that, like, when he was getting shown the place, he was like, "Yeah, the guy downstairs, he's black, but he's okay." Talking about
me.
And I believe it. He was extremely misogynistic to like the neighbors, and like anytime there was something wrong, he would automatically blame the women first, any women who lived in a building. He let somebody who was he was addicted to drugs and he very much needed help. And he was gone for a while and I thought he got the help, but then he came back and he was extremely disruptive. He allegedly threw his girlfriend out of the front porch window, like glass and everything everywhere. Yet he was fine to be there. It was me who was a problem, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was probably my worst landlord experience. I was fortunate enough like this time to have like, you know, my time in Rochester, I had one like company that was actually based out of Oregon, like be the super for like my first two places. Mm-hmm. Then the bad place, and then now I'm in a place where I'm friends with the landlord, you know. So I know that it can be even worse, and I'm thankful and I'm lucky that I haven't experienced worse around here.
When you concluded your piece for 540 West Main, you wrote that, you know, initially you wrote, "I'm not sure I have a point to all of this story, all of this," and you're talking about the story, but clearly you do, and clearly those of us who read it feel like you do, because you conclude by asking us to be very careful about judging and assuming that if somebody's asking for help, well, it's just a grift, mm-hmm. or, well, that person's got nice shoes, why do they need help? Or that person's got a cell phone, why do they need help? Tell me about assumptions and what happens when we make those kinds of assumptions.
Well, the thing is, when you make assumptions like that, just looking at somebody and saying, well, they got nice shoes. Well, what if somebody donated him that shoes or donated them that shoes? Or like in my situation, I was dressed pretty nicely for school and I was able to save all my clothes. Like that was one thing I got. I got all my clothes out of there. Like that didn't get picked over. So I'm still dressed relatively nicely at school and like looking for a job and all that stuff. So, you know, you can't say that I'm grifting if I still don't have like a house. I didn't have a job at the time. Like I didn't get a job until about, you know, 4 or 5 months after all this. And like, even then it was hard to get a job because you need an address to get a job. Like you need an address to fill out an application. So if my address changes from week to week, how am I supposed to even, you know, how am I supposed to apply for a job? How are they supposed to find me, you know? So, like, I hear it a lot. I hear it even from my friends, like, you know, well, this guy has, like, a 72-inch TV in his house. So how exactly is he poor? Or, you know, this guy is eating steak right now. Why is he eating steak when, you know, off of WIC money when I can only afford, you know, ground beef, you know, and I'm working three jobs, you know, maybe that guy's working three jobs too, you know, and like people become poor very quickly. It's not that hard to become poor. If I get laid off today, I can be poor. I can, and I will have, you know, I got a 50-inch TV and like two PlayStations. So like, am I supposed to throw those out just because I got laid off so I can say that I'm poor? Like people, it's very annoying to hear people's assumptions like that. Just because, you know, someone appears to not be what they expect a homeless person to be. It's like, I don't know. I feel like people think that you have to look like a waif from a Dickens novel in order to truly be poor and homeless. And that's just not the case.
Do you have people who you know that you've got a good job, solid, you're doing all these things, and then they find out that you had a stretch where you were houseless and they go, wait, you? Do they?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
All the time. Some people don't even believe me. Like, but it happened. Like, I don't know what to tell you. I guess you can look at my mom's credit, like credit record to see where we got evicted. Like that's the only way I'd be able to prove it, you know, beyond my own experience and beyond like the people that like I now, that now know, you know. But yeah, like it literally can happen to anybody.
Yeah, and I want to be careful when I ask this, but I am curious to know what your sort of disposition would be if you and I are out at one of Rochester's many coffee shops,
mm-hmm.
and a person who is homeless or houseless approaches us and just asks for a buck or says hello and says they could use some help. How do you respond in those situations?
Usually they make a pretty lengthy story, and usually I cut them off and just say, what do you need? And then that's it. And yeah, it could be a grift. And if it is, you know,
to be clear, like I usually don't think it's a grift.
No.
I don't go in from the assumption that it's a grift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually if I got the cash, I'll give them the cash. If I don't have the cash, I'll offer them food. You know, like that's my go-to now. I try to walk around with cash, but like, you know, as technology keeps progressing, you know, carrying cash on you is a lot harder.
I found that to be true as well. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, the reason I want to be careful in talking about this is there's a lot of schools of thought in working and actually trying to help people who are houseless or homeless. And I am not perfect and I'm not some sort of saint. But yes, like if people approach me, I actually usually just ask them how they're doing. I will give them some cash if I have mm-hmm. it. But I found lately I just don't have cash on me very much. And I kind of feel bad about that because there's like this suspicion, like, come on, because I'm sure a lot of people just ignore the request.
Yeah, a lot of people do. And like if that's, I'd much prefer like somebody ignore the request than like come back at them with anger.
Oh, yeah.
Like
yeah.
Or like some sort of backhanded comment about like, well, why don't you find a job or something like that?
No,
like
that
doesn't help.
No. I usually offer a handshake or a hug and mm-hmm. and then just a conversation about like, where are you staying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you aware of resources that are out there? But to your point, sometimes it feels like resources get exhausted really quick.
Oh, yeah. And they keep getting cut. Like that's another thing that happened. Like even in Baltimore, like the Section 8 program that I was on doesn't exist in the way it should. Like the fact that there was a 2-year wait for us, and that was back in 1995, you know, it took us 2 years to get it, you know, to get housing. That's insane. Like people will die, you know, waiting for housing. Like if my mom couldn't be in like a women's shelter or multiple women's shelters, then yeah, she probably would have actually completed suicide. And then I'd be like a for real orphan at like 17, you know? So yeah. And these programs keep getting cut and we keep making these ridiculous hurdles to them. Like, you know, the person needs to be drug tested or something, which costs more to drug test everybody who's going to be on a welfare program mm-hmm. than it does to just give the person, you know, whatever resources they need to get off the street.
So 90 seconds as we get ready to wrap here. Let people know where they can find your work here. This was in 540 West Main where you're a contributing writer. You're doing some podcast work.
Yes. So I've got a podcast with my buddy Dario Joseph. It's called Refined Taste with Dario and Chris. We just go around to local Rochester businesses, interview them, try to promote them as much as possible. We try to go with like the smaller places, but you know we'll do a staple like Swan's Market, or we'll be doing a certain brewery pretty soon that I'm excited about. But yeah, we try to get to the
hold on the picture of this Refined Taste with Dario and Chris. Are you sitting in front of a fireplace here?
Yeah, that's us in front of a fireplace. It's all CGI, but.
Like I'm like trying to see like do you have like a cognac or something? You look very refined.
Definitely a cognac. That's
so the podcast is Refined Taste with Dario and Chris. Chris is always worth following just for the writings and you know, I mean his stuff is not provocative just to sort of inflame. He'll make you think and it's important. And on our last 30 seconds here, these problems are really entrenched. You talk about programs being cut, but there's mm-hmm. also just an income inequality side of things. I mean, people are having a hard time finding work that pays them enough to really afford a lot of rent here. Mm-hmm. Is there a short answer in 25 seconds? Do you want to see something happen next year that will help with this?
I mean, raising the minimum wage would help, like just making it statewide. Like I know a lot of companies are privately are doing that already. And also, like, if there was, like, housing should be, like, just, it should be a human right. I know it sounds cliche, but, like, Salt Lake City tried and succeeded with this. So they just gave houses to the homeless. And it worked.
Kathy writes, the hardest part to listen to this is the whole culture of grift that preys on poverty-stricken people. Mm-hmm. Law enforcement allowing belongings to be stolen and sometimes contracts with people to give them first dibs on evicted belongings. We hear these stories. Our society is so broken, and I am so glad your guest shared this. Thank you. That's from Kathy in Chilliwack. A lot of feedback like that. Great work on this, and I really appreciate you sharing this, and it's great to see you in person.
Yes. Finally.
Yes.
We can hug.
Yes. I'm going to sign off this show and go hug Chris Thompson, and we'll be right back in a second with more Connections.